the great sadness of Barrington's life. He did not blame her for going. He had been hopelessly unfaithful. But he had loved her, and he still missed her, 13 years after the divorce. The fact that he was at fault only made him sadder. Joshing with her on the phone reminded him of how much fun they had had together in the good times. He turned on the TV and watched Primetime Live while his dinner was warming. The kitchen filled with the fragrance of the herbs Marianne used. She was a great cook. Perhaps it was because Martinique had been a French colony. Just as he was taking the casserole out of the oven, the phone rang again. This time it was Preston Bach. He sounded shaken. "I just heard from Dick Minsky in Philadelphia," he said. "Jeannie Ferrami has made an appointment to go to the Aventine Clinic tomorrow." Barrington sat down heavily. "Christ on a pony," he said. "How the hell did she get onto the clinic?" "I don't know. Dick wasn't there. The night manager took the call, but apparently she said some of her research subjects had treatment years ago and she wanted to check their medical records. Promised to fax over her releases and said she'd be there at 2 p.m. Thank God, Dick happened to call in about something else and the night manager mentioned it." Dick Minsky had been one of the first people Genetico had hired back in the 70s. He had been the mailroom boy then. Now he was general manager of the clinics. He had never been a member of the inner circle. Only Jim Preston and Barrington could ever belong to that club. But he knew that the company's past held secrets. Discretion was automatic with him. "What did you tell Dick to do?" "Cancel the appointment, of course. If she shows up anyway, turn her away. Tell her she can't see the records." Barrington shook his head. "Not good enough." "Why?" "It will just make her more curious. She'll try to find some other way to get at the files." "Like how?" Barrington sighed. Preston could be unimaginative. "Well, if I were her, I'd call Landsman, get Michael Madigan's secretary on the phone, and say he ought to look at the Aventine Clinic's records from 23 years ago before he closes the takeover deal. That would get him asking questions, wouldn't it?" "Well, what do you suggest?" Preston said tetchily. "I think we're going to have to shred all the record cards from the 70s. There was a moment of silence. "Barry, those records are unique. Scientifically, they're priceless. You think I don't know that?" Barrington snapped. "There must be another way." Barrington sighed. He felt as bad as Preston did about it. He had fondly imagined that one day, many years in the future, someone would write the story of their pioneering experiments, and their boldness and scientific brilliance would be revealed to the world. It broke his heart to see the historical evidence wiped out in this guilty and underhand way. But it was inevitable now. "While the records exist, they're a threat to us. They have to be destroyed, and it had better be done right away." "What do we tell the staff?" "Shit, I don't know. Preston, make something up, for Christ's sake. New corporate document management strategy. So long as they start shredding, first thing in the morning, I don't care what you tell them." "I guess you're right. Okay, I'll get back to Dick right away. Will you call Jim and bring him up to date?" "Sure. Bye." Barrington dialed Jim Proust's home number. His wife, a wispy woman with a downtrodden air, answered the phone and put Jim on. "I'm in bed, Barry. What the hell is it now?" The three of them were getting very snappy with one another. Barrington told Jim what Preston had reported and the action they had decided on. "Good move," Jim said. "But it's not enough. There are other ways this Ferrami woman could come at us." Barrington felt a spasm of irritation. Nothing was ever enough for Jim. No matter what you proposed, Jim would always want tougher action, more extreme measures. Then he suppressed his annoyance. Jim was making sense this time, he reflected. Jeannie had proved to be a real bloodhound, unwavering in her pursuit of the scent. One setback would not make her give up. "I agree," he said to Jim. "And Steve Logan is out of jail, I heard earlier today, so she's not entirely alone. We have to deal with her long term."
"She has to be scared off."
"Jim, for Christ's sake. I know this brings out the wimp in you, Barry, but it has to be done." "Forget it. Look, I have a better idea, Jim, if you'll listen for a minute."
"Okay, I'm listening."
"I'm going to have her fired." Jim thought about it for a while.
"I don't know. Will that do it?
Sure. Look, she imagines she stumbled on a biological anomaly. It's the kind of thing that could make a young scientist's career. She has no idea of what's underneath all this. She believes the university is just afraid of bad publicity. If she loses her job, she'll have no facilities to pursue her investigation and no reason to stick to it. Besides, she'll be too busy looking for another job. I happen to know she needs money.
Maybe you're right.
Barrington was suspicious. Jim was agreeing too readily.
You're not planning to do something on your own, are you?
He said. Jim evaded the question.
Can you do that? Can you get her fired?
Sure.
But you told me Tuesday that it's a university, not the fucking army.
That's true. You can't just yell at people and they do what you told them. But I've been in the academic world for most of the last 40 years. I know how to work the machinery. When it's really necessary, I can get rid of an assistant professor without breaking a sweat.
Okay.
Barrington frowned.
We're together on this. Right, Jim?
Right. Okay. Sleep well.
Good night.
Barrington hung up the phone. His chicken Provençal was cold. He dumped it in the trash and went to bed. He lay awake for a long time, thinking about Jeannie Ferrami. At 2 a.m., he got up and took a Dalmane. Then, at last, he went to sleep. 29. It was a hot night in Philadelphia. In the tenement building, all the doors and windows were open. None of the rooms had air conditioning. The sounds of the street floated up to apartment 5A on the top floor. Car horns, laughter, snatches of music. On a cheap pine desk, scratched and marked with old cigarette burns, a phone was ringing. He picked it up. A voice like a bark said,
"This is Jim."
"Hey, Uncle Jim. How are you?"
"I'm worried about you."
"How so?"
"I know what happened on Sunday night."
He hesitated, not sure how to reply.
"They've arrested someone for that."
"But his girlfriend thinks he's innocent."
"So?"
"She's coming to Philadelphia tomorrow."
"What for?"
"I'm not sure, but I think she's a danger."
"Shit.
You may want to do something about her."
"Such as?"
"It's up to you."
"How would I find her?"
"Do you know the Aventine Clinic? It's in your neighborhood."
"Sure, it's on Chestnut. I pass it every day."
"She'll be there at 2 p.m.
"How will I know her?"
"Tall, dark hair, pierced nostril. About 30.
"That could be a lot of women."
"She'll probably be driving an old red Mercedes."
"That narrows it down."
"Now bear in mind, the other guy is out on bail."
He frowned.
"So what?"
"So, if she should meet with an accident after she's been seen with you..."
"I get it. They'll assume it was him."
"You always were quick-thinking, my boy."
He laughed.
"And you always were mean-thinking, Uncle."
"One more thing."
"I'm listening."
"She's beautiful. So enjoy."
"Bye, Uncle Jim."
"And thanks."
Thursday. 30. Jeannie had the Thunderbird dream again. The first part of the dream was something that really happened when she was 9 and her sister was 6, and their father was, briefly, living with them. He was flush with money at the time, and it was not until years later that Jeannie realized he must have got it from a successful robbery. He brought home a new Ford Thunderbird with a turquoise paint job and matching turquoise upholstery, the most beautiful car imaginable to a 9-year-old girl. They all went for a ride, Jeannie and Patty sitting in the front on the bench seat between Daddy and Mom. As they were cruising along the George Washington Memorial Parkway, Daddy put Jeannie on his lap and let her take the wheel. In real life, she had steered the car into the fast lane and got a fright when a car that was trying to pass honked loudly, and Daddy jerked the wheel and brought the Thunderbird back on track. But in the dream, Daddy was no longer there. She was driving without help, and Mom and Patty sat quite unperturbed beside her, even though they knew she couldn't see over the dashboard, and she just gripped the wheel tighter and tighter and tighter, waiting for the crash, while the other cars honked the doorbell at her. louder and louder. She woke up with her fingernails digging into the palms of her hands and the insistent chime of her doorbell in her ears. It was 6 a.m. She lay still for a moment, savoring the relief that washed over her from the realization that it was only a dream. Then she jumped out of bed and went to the entry phone. "Hello? It's Gita. Wake up and let me in." Gita lived in Baltimore and worked at FBI headquarters in Washington. She must be on her way to the office for an early start, Jeannie thought. She pressed the button that opened the door. Jeannie pulled on an oversized T-shirt that reached almost to her knees. It was decent enough for a girlfriend. Gita came up the stairs, the picture of a fast-rising corporate executive in a navy linen suit, black hair cut in a bob, stud earrings, large, lightweight glasses, New York Times under her arm. "What the hell is going on?" Gita said without preamble. Jeannie said, "I don't know. I just woke up." This was going to be bad news. She could tell. "My boss called me at home late last night and told me to have nothing more to do with you." No! She needed the FBI results to show that her method worked, despite the puzzle of Stephen and Dennis. Damn! Did he say why? Claimed your methods infringed people's privacy. Unusual for the FBI to worry about a little thing like that. It seems the New York Times feels the same way. Gita showed Jeannie the newspaper. On the front page was an article headed, "Gene Research Ethics. Doubts, Fears, and a Squabble." Jeannie was afraid the squabble was a reference to her own situation. And she was right. "Jean Ferrami is a determined young woman. Against the wishes of her scientific colleagues and the president of Jones Falls University in Baltimore, Maryland, she stubbornly insists on continuing to scan medical records looking for twins. I've got a contract, she says. They can't give me orders, and doubts about the ethics of her work will not shake her resolve." Jeannie had a sick feeling in the pit of her stomach. "My God, this is awful," she said. The report then moved on to another topic, research on human embryos, and Jeannie had to turn to page 19 before she found another reference to herself. "A new headache for college authorities has been created by the case of Dr. Jean Ferrami of the psychology department at Jones Falls. Although the university president, Dr. Maurice O'Bell, and leading psychologist, Professor Barrington Jones, both agree her work is unethical, she refuses to stop, and there may be nothing they can do to compel her." Jeannie read to the end, but the newspaper did not report her insistence that her work was ethically blameless. The focus was entirely on the drama of her defiance. It was shocking and painful to be attacked this way. She felt hurt and outraged at the same time, the way she had when a thief had knocked her flying and snatched her billfold in a supermarket in Minneapolis years ago. Even though she knew the reporter was malicious and unscrupulous, she was ashamed, as if she had really done wrong. And she felt exposed, held up to the scorn of the nation. "I may have trouble finding anyone who will let me scan a database now," she said despondently. "Do you want some coffee? I need something to cheer me up. Not many days start as badly as this." "I'm sorry, Jeannie, but I'm in trouble too, for getting the Bureau involved." As Jeannie started the coffee machine, she was struck by a thought. This article is unfair, but if your boss spoke to you last night, it can't have been the newspaper that prompted his call. Maybe he knew the article was coming. I wonder who tipped him off. He didn't say exactly, but he told me he had had a phone call from Capitol Hill. Jeannie frowned. It sounds as if this is political. Why the hell would a congressman or senator be interested enough in what I'm doing to tell the FBI not to work with me? Maybe it was just a friendly warning from someone who knew about the article. Jeannie shook her head. The article doesn't mention the Bureau. Nobody else knows I'm working on FBI files. I didn't even tell Barrington. I'll try to find out who the call came from. Jeannie looked in her freezer. Have you had breakfast? I have cinnamon buns. No, thanks. I guess I'm not hungry either. She closed the refrigerator door. She felt despairing. Was there nothing she could do?
Gita, I don't suppose you could run my scan without your boss's knowledge.
She did not have much hope that Gita would agree, but the answer surprised her. Gita frowned and said, Didn't you get my email yesterday?
I left early.
What did it say?
That I was going to run your scan last night.
And did you?
Yes, that's why I've come to see you.
I did it last night, before he called me.
Suddenly, Jeannie was hopeful again.
What? And you have the results?
I sent them to you by email.
Jeannie was thrilled. But that's great! Did you look? Were there many twins?
Quite a lot. 20 or 30 pairs.
That's great! That means the system works.
But I told my boss I hadn't run the scan. I was scared and I lied.
Jeannie frowned. That's awkward. I mean, what if he finds out at some time in the future?
Exactly. Jeannie, you have to destroy that list.
What?
If he ever finds out about it, I'm finished.
But I can't destroy it. Not if it proves me right.
Gita's face set in determined lines.
You have to.
This is awful, Jeannie said miserably.
How can I destroy something that might save me?
I got into this by doing you a favor, Gita said, wagging a finger.
You have to get me out of it.
Jeannie did not see that it was entirely her fault. With a touch of acerbity, she said, I didn't tell you to lie to your boss.
That angered Gita. I was scared.
Wait a minute, Jeannie said. Let's stay cool.
She poured coffee into mugs and gave Gita one. Suppose you go into work today and tell your boss there was a misunderstanding. You gave instructions that the sweep should be canceled, but you later found it had already been carried out and the results emailed.
Gita took her coffee but did not drink it. She seemed close to tears. Can you imagine working for the FBI?
I'm up against the most macho men in Middle America. They're looking for any excuse to say that women can't hack it.
But you won't get fired. You got me over a barrel.
It was true. There was nothing Gita could say to force Jeannie.
But Jeannie said, Come on, it's not that way.
Gita did not soften. Yes, it is that way. I'm asking you to destroy that list.
I can't.
Then there's nothing more to say.
Gita went to the door.
Don't leave like this, Jeannie said. We've been friends for too long.
Gita went.
Shit, Jeannie said. Shit! The street door slammed. Did I just lose one of my oldest friends? Jeannie thought.
Gita had let her down.
Jeannie understood the reasons. There was a lot of pressure on a young woman trying to make a career. All the same, it was Jeannie who was under attack, not Gita. Gita's friendship had not survived the test of a crisis.
Jeannie wondered if other friends would go the same way.
Feeling miserable, she took a quick shower and began to throw on her clothes. Then she made herself stop and think. She was going into battle. She had better dress for it. She took off her black jeans and red t-shirt and started again. She washed and blow-dried her hair. She made up her face carefully. Foundation, powder, mascara, and lipstick. She dressed in a black suit with a dove-gray blouse, sheer stockings and patent leather pumps. She changed her nose ring for a plain stud. She studied herself in a full-length mirror. She felt dangerous, and she looked formidable.
Kill, Jeannie.
Kill,
she murmured.
Then she went out. 31. Jeannie thought about Steve Logan as she drove to JFU. She had called him a big, strong kid, but in fact he was more mature than some men ever got to be. She had cried on his shoulder, so she must trust him at some deep level. She had liked the way he smelled, sort of like tobacco before it is lit. Despite her distress, she could not help noticing his erection, although he had tried not to let her feel it. It was flattering that he should get so excited just hugging her, and she smiled as she recalled the scene. It was a pity he was not 10 or 15 years older. Steve reminded her of her first love, Bobby Springfield. She was 13, he was 15. She knew almost nothing about love and sex, but he was equally ignorant, and they had embarked on a voyage of discovery together. She blushed as she remembered the things they had done in the back row of the movie-drome on Saturday nights. The exciting thing about Bobby, as with Steve, was a sense of passion constrained. Bobby had wanted her so badly, and had been so inflamed by stroking her nipples or touching her panties, that she had felt enormously powerful. For a while, she had abused that power, getting him all hot and bothered just to prove she could do it. But she soon realized, even at the age of 13, that that was a foolish game. Still, she never lost the sense of risk, of delight in playing with a chain giant. And she felt that with Steve. He was the only good thing on her horizon. She was in bad trouble. She could not resign from her post here at JFU now. After the New York Times had made her famous for defying her bosses, she would find it hard to get another scientific job. If I were a professor, I wouldn't hire someone who caused this kind of trouble, she thought. But it was too late for her to take a more cautious stance. Her only hope was to press on stubbornly, using the FBI data, and produce scientific results so convincing that people would look again at her methodology and debate its ethics seriously. It was 9 o'clock when she pulled into her parking space. As she locked the car and walked into Nuthouse, she had an acid feeling in her stomach. Too much tension and no food. As soon as she stepped into her office, she knew someone had been there. It was not the cleaners. She was familiar with the changes they made. The chairs shifted an inch or two, cup rings swabbed, the wastebasket on the wrong side of the desk. This was different. Someone had sat at her computer. The keyboard was at the wrong angle. The intruder had unconsciously shifted it to his or her habitual position. The mouse had been left in the middle of the pad, whereas she always tucked it neatly up against the edge of the keyboard. Looking around, she noticed a cupboard door open a crack and a corner of paper sticking out of the edge of a filing cabinet. The room had been searched. At least, she reflected, it had been done amateurishly. It was not like the CIA was after her. All the same, it made her deeply uneasy, and she had butterflies in her stomach as she sat down and turned on her PC. Who had been here? A member of the faculty? A student? A bribed security guard? Some outsider? And why? An envelope had been slipped under her door. It contained a release signed by Lorraine Logan and faxed to Nuthouse by Steve. She took Charlotte Pinker's release out of a file and put both in her briefcase. She would fax them to the Aventine Clinic. She sat at her desk and retrieved her email. There was only one message, the results of the FBI scan. Hallelujah, she breathed. She downloaded the list of names and addresses with profound relief. She was vindicated. The scan had in fact found pairs. She could hardly wait to check them out and see whether there were any more anomalies like Steve and Dennis. Gita had sent her an earlier email message saying she was going to run the scan, Jeannie recalled. What had happened to that? She wondered if it had been downloaded by last night's snooper. That could explain the panicky late-night call to Gita's boss. She was about to look at the names on the list when the phone rang. It was the university president. Maurice O'Bell here. I think we had better discuss this report in the New York Times. Don't you? Jeannie's stomach tightened. Here we go, she thought apprehensively. It begins. Of course, she said. What time would suit you? I was hoping you might step into my office right away. I'll be there in 5 minutes. She copied the FBI results onto a floppy disk, then exited from the internet. She took the disk out of her computer and picked up a pen. She thought for a moment, then wrote on the label, shopping.lst. No doubt it was an unnecessary precaution, but it made her feel better. She slipped the floppy into the box containing her backup files and went out. The day was already heating up. As she crossed the campus, she asked herself what she wanted out of this meeting with O'Bell. Her only objective was to be allowed to continue with her research. She needed to be tough and make it clear she was not to be bullied. But ideally, she would soothe the anger of the university authorities and de-escalate the conflict. She was glad she had worn the black suit, even though she was sweating in it. It made her look older and more authoritative. Her high heels clacked on the flagstones as she approached Hillside Hall. She was ushered straight into the president's lavish office. Barrington Jones was sitting there, a copy of the New York Times in his hand. She smiled at him, glad to have an ally. He nodded rather coolly and said, "Good morning, Jeannie." Maurice LaBelle was in his wheelchair behind his big desk. With his usual abrupt manner, he said, "The university simply cannot tolerate this, Dr. Ferrami." He did not ask her to sit, but she was not going to be scolded like a schoolgirl, so she selected a chair, moved it, sat down, and crossed her legs. "It was a pity you told the press you had canceled my project before checking whether you had the legal right to do so," she said as coolly as she could. "I fully agree with you that it made the college look foolish." He bridled. "It was not I who made us look foolish." That was enough being tough, she decided. Now was the moment to tell him they were both on the same side. She uncrossed her legs. "Of course not," she said. "The truth is, we were both a little hasty, and the press took advantage of us." Barrington put in, "The damage is done now. There's no point in apologizing." "I wasn't apologizing," she snapped. She turned back to O'Bell and smiled. "However, I do think we should stop bickering." Once again, Barrington answered her. "It's too late for that," he said. "I'm sure it's not," she said. She wondered why Barrington had said that. He ought to want a reconciliation. It was not in his interests to be inflammatory. She kept her eyes and her smile on the president. "We're rational people. We must be able to find a compromise that would allow me to continue my work and yet preserve the university's dignity." O'Bell clearly liked that idea, although he frowned and said, "I don't quite see how..." "This is all a waste of time," Barrington said impatiently. It was the third time he had made a quarrelsome interjection. Jeannie choked back another washfish rejoinder. Why was he being like this? Did he want her to stop doing her research and get into trouble with the university and be discredited? It began to seem that way. Was it Barrington, who had sneaked into her room and downloaded her email and warned off the FBI? Could it even be he who had tipped off the New York Times in the first place and started this whole row? She was so stunned by the perverse logic of this notion that she fell silent. "We have already decided the university's course of action," Barrington said. She realized she had mistaken the power structure in the room. Barrington was the boss here, not O'Bell. Barrington was the conduit for Genetico's research millions, which O'Bell needed. Barrington had nothing to fear from O'Bell, rather the reverse. She had been watching the monkey instead of the organ grinder. Barrington had now dropped the pretense that the university president was in charge. "We didn't call you in here to ask your opinion," he said. "Then why did you call me in?" Jeannie asked. "To fire you," he replied. She was stunned. She had expected the threat of dismissal, but not the thing itself. She could hardly take it in. "What do you mean?" she said stupidly.
"I mean you're fired," Barrington said.
He smoothed his eyebrows with the tip of his right index finger, a sign that he was pleased with himself. Jeannie felt as if she had been punched. "I can't be fired," she thought. "I've only been here a few weeks. I was getting on so well, working so hard. I thought they all liked me, except Sophie Chapel. How did this happen so fast?" She tried to collect her thoughts. "You can't fire me," she said.
"We just did."
"No." As she got over the initial shock, she began to feel angry and defiant. "You're not tribal chieftains here. There's a procedure. Universities usually could not fire faculty without some kind of hearing. It was mentioned in her contract, but she had never checked the details. Suddenly, it was vitally important to her. Maurice O'Bell supplied the information. "There will be a hearing before the Discipline Committee of the University Senate, of course," he said. "Normally, 4 weeks' notice is required. But in view of the bad publicity surrounding this case, I, as president, have invoked the emergency procedure, and the hearing will be held tomorrow morning." Jeannie was bewildered by how fast they had acted. The Discipline Committee? Emergency procedure? Tomorrow morning? This was not a discussion. It was more like being arrested. She half expected Obel to read her her rights. He did something similar. He pushed a folder across his desk. In there, you will find the procedural rules of the committee. You may be represented by a lawyer or other advocate, provided you notify the chair of the committee in advance. Jeannie at last managed a sensible question. Who's the chair?
Jack Budgeon, said Obel.
Barrington looked up sharply.
Is that already settled?
The chair is appointed annually, Obel said. Jack took over at the start of the semester.
I didn't know that.
Barrington looked annoyed, and Jeannie knew why. Jack Budgeon was her tennis partner. That was encouraging. He ought to be fair to her. All was not lost. She would have a chance to defend herself and her research methods in front of a group of academics. There would be a serious discussion, not the glib superficialities of the New York Times. And she had the results of her FBI sweep. She began to see how she would defend herself. She would show the committee the FBI data. With luck, there would be one or two pairs who did not know they were twins. That would be impressive. Then she would explain the precautions she took to protect individuals' privacy.
I think that's all, said Maurice Obel.
Jeannie was being dismissed. She stood up. What a pity it's come to this, she said.
Barrington said quickly, You brought it to this.
He was like an argumentative child. She did not have the patience for pointless wrangling. She gave him a disdainful look and left the room. As she crossed the campus, she reflected ruefully that she had completely failed to achieve her aims. She had wanted a negotiated settlement, and she had got a gladiatorial contest. But Barrington and Obel had made their decision before she walked into the room. The meeting had been a formality. She returned to Nutt House. As she approached her office, she noticed with irritation that the cleaners had left a black plastic garbage bag right outside the door. She would call them immediately. But when she tried to open her door, it seemed to be jammed. She swiped her card through the card reader several times, but the door did not open. She was about to walk to reception and call maintenance when a dreadful thought occurred to her. She looked inside the black bag. It was not full of waste paper and styrofoam coffee cups. The first thing she saw was her canvas Land's End briefcase. Also in the sack was a Kleenex box from her drawer, a paperback copy of 1,000 Acres by Jane Smiley, 2 framed photographs, and her hairbrush. They had cleared out her desk and locked her out of her office. She was devastated. This was a worse blow than what had happened in Maurice Obel's office. That was just words. This made her feel cut off from a huge part of her life. This is my office, she thought. How can they shut me out? You fucking creeps, she said aloud. It must have been done by security while she was in Obel's office. Of course they had not warned her. That would have given her the chance to take anything she really needed. Once again, she had been surprised by their ruthlessness. It was like an amputation. They had taken away her science, her work. She did not know what to do with herself, where to go. For 11 years, she had been a scientist, as an undergraduate, graduate student, doctoral student, postdoctoral, and assistant professor. Now, suddenly, she was nothing. As her spirit sank from despondency to black despair, she remembered the disk with the FBI data. She rummaged through the contents of the plastic sack, but there were no floppy disks. Her results, the backbone of her defense, were locked inside the room. She pounded futilely on the door with her fist. A passing student who took her statistics class gave her a startled look and said, Can I help you, Professor? She recalled his name. Hi, Ben. You could kick down this goddamn door. He studied the door, looking dubious. I didn't mean it, she said. I'm fine, thanks. He shrugged and walked on. There was no point standing and staring at the locked door. She picked up the plastic bag and walked into the lab. Lisa was at her desk, keying data into a computer. I've been fired, Jeannie said. Lisa stared at her. What? They locked me out of my office and dumped my stuff in this fucking garbage bag. I don't believe it. Jeannie took her briefcase out of the bag and extracted the New York Times. It's on account of this. Lisa read the first 2 paragraphs and said, But this is bullshit. Jeannie sat down. I know. So why is Barrington pretending to take it seriously?
You think he's pretending?
I'm sure of it. He's too smart to let himself be rattled by this kind of crap. He has some other agenda.
Jeannie drummed her feet on the floor, helpless with frustration.
He's ready to do anything. He's really going out on a limb with this. There must be something big at stake for him.
Perhaps she would find the answer in the medical records of the Aventine Clinic in Philadelphia. She checked her watch. She was due there at 2 p.m. She had to leave soon.
Lisa still could not take in the news. They can't just fire you, she said indignantly.
There's a disciplinary hearing tomorrow morning.
My God, they're serious.
They sure are.
Is there anything I can do?
There was, but Jeannie was afraid to ask. She looked appraisingly at Lisa. Lisa was wearing a high-necked blouse with a loose sweater over it, despite the hot weather. She was covering up her body, a reaction to the rape, no doubt. She still looked solemn, like someone recently bereaved. Would her friendship prove as fragile as Gita's? Jeannie was terrified of the answer. If Lisa let her down, who would she have left? But she had to put her to the test, even though this was the worst possible time.
You could try to get into my office, she said hesitantly. The results from the FBI are in there.
Lisa did not answer right away. Did they change your lock or something?
It's easier than that. They altered the code electronically so that your card no longer works. I won't be able to get into the building after hours either, I'll bet.
It's hard to take this in. It's happened so quickly.
Jeannie hated pressuring Lisa to take risks. She racked her brains for a way out.
Maybe I could get in myself. A cleaner might let me in, but my guess is that the lock will no longer respond to their cards either. If I'm not using the room, it won't need cleaning anyway. But security must be able to get in.
They won't help you. They'll know you've been locked out deliberately.
That's true, Jeannie said.
They might let you in, though. You could say you needed something from my office.
Lisa looked thoughtful.
I hate to ask you, Jeannie said.
Then Lisa's expression changed.
Hell yes, she said at last. Of course I'll try it.
Jeannie felt choked up.
Thanks, she said.
She bit her lip.
You're a friend.
She reached across the desk and squeezed Lisa's hand. Lisa was embarrassed by Jeannie's emotion.
Where in your office is the FBI list? She said practically.
The information is on a floppy disk labeled shopping.lst in a box of floppies in my desk drawer.
Got it.
Lisa frowned.
I can't understand why they're so against you.
It all started with Steve Logan, Jeannie said. Ever since Barrington saw him here, there has been trouble. But I think I may be on the way to understanding why.
She stood up.
What are you going to do now? Said Lisa.
I'm going to Philadelphia.
32. Barrington stared out of the window of his office. No one was using the tennis court this morning. His imagination pictured Jeannie there. He had seen her on the first or second day of the semester, racing across the court in her short skirt, brown legs pumping, white shoes flashing. He had fallen for her then. He frowned, wondering why he had been so struck by her athleticism. Seeing women play sports was not a special turn-on for him. He never watched American Gladiators, unlike Professor Gormley in Egyptology, who had every show on videotapes and reran them, according to rumor, late at night in his den at home. But when Jeannie played tennis, she achieved a special grace. It was like watching a lion break into a sprint in a nature film. The muscles flowed beneath the skin, the hair flew in the slipstream, and the body moved, stopped, turned, and moved again with astonishing supernatural suddenness. It was mesmerizing to watch, and he had been captivated. Now she was threatening everything he had worked for all his life, yet he still wished he could watch her play tennis one more time. It was maddening that he could not simply dismiss her, even though her salary was essentially paid by him. Jones Falls University was her employer, and Genetico had already given them the money.
A college could not fire faculty the way a restaurant could fire an incompetent waiter. That was why he had to go through this rigmarole.
The hell with her, he said aloud,
and he went back to his desk. This morning's interview had proceeded smoothly until the revelation about Jack Budgeon. Barrington had got Maurice good and riled in advance and had neatly prevented any rapprochement. But it was bad news that the chair of the discipline committee was to be Jeannie's tennis partner. Barrington had not checked this out in advance. He had assumed he would have some influence over the choice of chair, and he had been dismayed to learn that the appointment was a done thing. There was a grave danger Jack would see Jeannie's side of the story. He scratched his head worriedly. Barrington never socialized with his academic colleagues. He preferred the more glamorous company of political and media types. But he knew Jack Budgeon's background. Jack had retired from professional tennis at the age of 30 and returned to college to get his doctorate. Already too old to begin a career in chemistry, his subject, he had become an administrator, running the university's complex of libraries and balancing the conflicting demands of rival departments. Required a tactful and obliging nature, and Jack did it well. How could Jack be swayed? He was not a devious man. Quite the reverse. His easygoing nature went along with a kind of naivete. He would be offended if Barrington lobbied him openly or blatantly offered some kind of bribe. But it might be possible to influence him discreetly. Barrington himself had accepted a bribe once. He still felt knots in his guts whenever he thought of it. It had happened early in his career, before he had become a full professor. A woman undergraduate had been caught cheating, paying another student to write her term paper. Her name was Judy Gilmore, and she was really cute. She ought to have been expelled from the university, but the head of the department had the power to impose a lesser punishment. Judy had come to Barrington's office to talk about the problem. She had crossed and uncrossed her legs and gazed mournfully into his eyes and bent forward so that he could look down the front of her shirt and glimpse a lacy brassiere. He had been sympathetic and had promised to intercede for her. She had cried and thanked him, then taken his hand, then kissed him on the lips. And finally she had unzipped his fly. She had never suggested a deal. She had not offered him sex before he had agreed to help her, and after they had screwed on the floor, she had calmly dressed and combed her hair and kissed him and left. But the next day, he had persuaded the department head to let her off with a warning. He had taken the bribe because he had been able to tell himself it was not a bribe. Judy had asked him for help. He had agreed. She had fallen for his charms, and they had made love. As time went by, he had come to see this as pure sophistry. The offer of sex had been implicit in her manner, and when he had promised her what she asked, she had wisely sealed the bargain. He liked to think of himself as a principled man, and he had done something absolutely shameful. Bribing someone was almost as bad as taking a bribe. All the same, he would bribe Jack Budgeon if he could. The thought made him grimace in disgust, but it had to be done. He was desperate. He would do it the way Judy had, by giving Jack the opportunity to kid himself about it. Barrington thought for a few minutes more. Then he picked up the phone and called Jack. "Thanks for sending me a copy of your memo about the biophysics library extension," he began. There was a startled pause. "Oh, yes, that was a while ago, but I'm glad you found time to read it." Barrington had barely glanced at the document. "I think your proposal has a lot of merit. I'm just calling to say that I'll back you when it comes before the Appropriations Board." "Thank you. I appreciate that. In fact, I might be able to persuade Genetico to put up part of the funding." Jack seized on that idea eagerly. "We could call it the Genetico Biophysics Library." "Good idea. I'll speak to them about it." Barrington wanted Jack to bring up the subject of Jeannie. Maybe they could get to her via tennis. "How was your summer?" he said. "Did you get to Wimbledon?" "Not this year. Too much work." "That's too bad." With trepidation, he pretended he was about to hang up. "Talk to you later." As he had hoped, Jack forestalled him. "Barry, what do you think about this crap in the newspapers? About Jeannie?" Barrington concealed his relief and spoke dismissively. "Oh, that tempest in a teapot." I've been trying to call her, but she's not in her office.
Don't worry about Genetico, Barrington said, although Jack had not mentioned the company. They're relaxed about the whole thing. Fortunately, Maurice O'Bell has acted quickly and decisively.
You mean the disciplinary hearing?
I imagine that will be a formality. She's embarrassing the university. She's refused to stop, and she's gone to the press. I doubt she'll even trouble to defend herself. I've told the people at Genetico that we have the situation under control. At present, there's no threat to the college's relationship with them.
That's good. Of course, if the committee should take Jeannie's side against Maurice, for some reason, we'd be in trouble. But I don't think that's very likely. Do you?
Barrington held his breath.
You know I'm chair of the committee.
Jack had evaded the question.
Damn you.
Yes, and I'm very pleased there's such a cool head in charge of the proceedings. He mentioned a shaven-headed professor of philosophy. If Malcolm Barnett had been chair, God knows what might have happened.
Jack laughed. The Senate has more sense. They wouldn't put Malcolm in charge of the parking committee. He tried to use it as an instrument of social change.
But with you in charge, I assume the committee will support the president.
Once again, Jack's reply was tantalizingly ambivalent. Not all the committee members are predictable.
You bastard, are you doing this to torment me?
But the chair is not a loose cannon. I'm sure of that.
Barrington wiped a droplet of sweat from his forehead. There was a pause.
Barry, it would be wrong for me to prejudge the issue.
The hell with you.
But I think I can say that Genetico need not worry about this.
At last.
Thank you, Jack. I appreciate it. Strictly between the two of us, of course.
Naturally.
Then I'll see you tomorrow.
Bye.
Barrington hung up.
Jesus, that was hard.
Did Jack really not know he had just been bribed? Did he kid himself about it? Or did he understand perfectly well, but simply pretend not to? It did not matter, so long as he steered the committee the right way. That might not be the end of it, of course. The committee's decision had to be ratified by a meeting of the full Senate. At some point, Jeannie might hire a hotshot lawyer and start to sue the university for all kinds of compensation. The case could drag on for years, but her investigations would be halted, and that was all that mattered. However, the committee's decision was not yet in the bag. If things went wrong tomorrow morning, Jeannie could be back at her desk by midday, hot on the trail of Genetico's guilty secrets.
Barrington shuddered. God forbid.
He pulled a scratch pad to him and wrote down the names of the committee members. Jack Budgeon, library. Tennille Bidenham, history of art. Milton Powers, mathematics. Mark Trader, anthropology. Jane Edelsborough, physics. Bidenham, Powers, and Trader were conventional men, long-standing professors whose careers were bound up with Jones Falls and its continued prestige and prosperity. They could be relied upon to support the university president, Barrington felt sure. The dark horse was the woman, Jane Edelsborough. He would deal with her next. 33. Driving to Philadelphia on I-95, Jeannie found herself thinking about Steve Logan again. She had kissed him goodbye last night in the visitor's parking lot on the Jones Falls campus. She found herself regretting that the kiss had been so fleeting. His lips were full and dry, his skin warm. She quite liked the idea of doing it again. Why was she prejudiced against him because of his age? What was so great about older men? Will Temple, age 39, had dropped her for an empty-headed heiress. So much for maturity. She pressed the seek button on her radio, looking for a good station, and got Nirvana playing Come As You Are. Whenever she thought about dating a man her own age or younger, she got a scared feeling, a bit like the frisson of danger that went with a Nirvana track. Older men were reassuring. They knew what to do.
Is this me? She thought. Jeannie Ferrami, the woman who does as she pleases and tells the world to go screw? I need reassurance? Get out of here.
It was true, though. Perhaps it was because of her father. After him, she never wanted another irresponsible man in her life. On the other hand, Her father was living proof that older men could be just as irresponsible as young. She guessed Daddy was sleeping in cheap hotels somewhere in Baltimore, when he had drunk and gambled whatever money he got for her computer and her TV, which would not take him long. He would either steal something else or throw himself on the mercy of his other daughter, Patty. Jeannie hated him for stealing her stuff. However, the incident had served to bring out the best in Steve Logan. He had been a prince. What the hell, she thought. When next I see Steve Logan, I'm going to kiss him again. And this time, I'll kiss him good. She became tense as she threaded the Mercedes through the crowded center of Philadelphia. This could be the big breakthrough. She might be about to find the solution to the puzzle of Steve and Dennis. The Aventine Clinic was in University City, west of the Schuylkill River, a neighborhood of college buildings and student apartments. The clinic itself was a pleasant low-rise 50s building surrounded by trees. Jeannie parked at a meter on the street and went inside. There were four people in the waiting area, a young couple, the woman looking strained and the man nervous, plus two other women of about Jeannie's age, all sitting in a square of low couches looking at magazines. A chirpy receptionist asked Jeannie to take a seat, and she picked up a glossy brochure about Genetico Incorporated. She held it open on her lap without reading it. Instead, she stared at the soothingly meaningless abstract art on the lobby walls and tapped her feet impatiently on the carpeted floor. She hated hospitals. She had only once been a patient. At the age of 23, she had had an abortion. The father was an aspiring film director. She stopped taking the contraceptive pill because they split up, but he came back after a few days. There was a loving reconciliation, and they had unprotected sex, and she got pregnant. The operation proceeded without complications, but Jeannie cried for days, and she lost all affection for the film director, even though he was supportive throughout. He had just made his first Hollywood movie, an action picture. Jeannie had gone alone to see it at the Charles Theater in Baltimore. The only touch of humanity in an otherwise mechanical story of men shooting at one another was when the hero's girlfriend became depressed after an abortion and threw him out. The man, a police detective, had been bewildered and heartbroken. Jeannie had cried. The memory still hurt. She stood up and paced the floor. A minute later, a man emerged from the back of the lobby and said, "Dr. Ferrami," in a loud voice. He was an anxiously jolly man of about 50, with a bald pate and a monkish fringe of ginger hair. "Hello, hello, good to meet you," he said with unwarranted enthusiasm. Jeannie shook his hand. "Last night I spoke to a Mr. Ringwood." "Yes, yes, I'm a colleague of his. My name's Dick Minsky. How do you do?" Dick had a nervous tic that made him blink violently every few seconds. Jeannie felt sorry for him. He led her up a staircase. "What's led to your inquiry, may I ask?" "A medical mystery," she explained. "The two women have sons who appear to be identical twins, yet they seem to be unrelated. The only connection I've been able to find is that both women were treated here before getting pregnant." "Is that so?" he said, as if he were not really listening. Jeannie was surprised. She had expected him to be intrigued. They entered a corner office. "All our records can be accessed by computer, provided you have the right code," he said. He sat at a screen. "Now, the patients we're interested in are Charlotte Pinker and Lorraine Logan." "This will take a minute." He began to key in the names. Jeannie contained her impatience. These records might reveal nothing at all. She looked around the room. It was too grand an office for a mere filing clerk. Dick must be more than just a colleague of Mr. Ringwood's, she thought. "What's your role here at the clinic, Dick?" she said. "I'm the general manager." She raised her eyebrows, but he did not look up from the keyboard. Why was her inquiry being dealt with by such a senior person, she wondered, and a sense of unease crept into her mood like a wisp of smoke. He frowned. "That's odd. The computer says we have no record of either name." Jeannie's unease gelled. "I'm about to be lied to," she thought. The prospect of a solution to the puzzle receded into the far distance again. A sense of anticlimax washed over her and depressed her. He spun his screen around so that she could see it.
Do I have the correct spellings?
Yes.
When do you think these patients attended the clinic?
Approximately 23 years ago. He looked at her.
Oh, dear, he said, and he blinked hard. Then I'm afraid you've made a wasted journey.
Why?
We don't keep records from that far back. It's our corporate document management strategy.
Jeannie narrowed her eyes at him.
You throw away old records? We shred the cards, yes, after 20 years. Unless, of course, the patient has been readmitted, in which case the record is transferred to the computer.
It was a sickening disappointment and a waste of precious hours that she needed to prepare her defense for tomorrow. She said bitterly,
How strange that Mr. Ringwood didn't tell me this when I talked to him last night. He really should have. Perhaps you didn't mention the dates.
I'm quite sure I told him the two women were treated here 23 years ago. Jeannie remembered adding a year to Steve's age to get the right period.
Then it's hard to understand.
Somehow Jeannie was not completely surprised at the way this had turned out. Dick Minsky, with his exaggerated friendliness and nervous blink, was the caricature of a man with a guilty conscience. He turned his screen back to its original position.
Seeming regretful, he said, I'm afraid there's no more I can do for you.
Could we talk to Mr. Ringwood and ask him why he didn't tell me about the cards being shredded?
I'm afraid Peter's off sick today.
What a remarkable coincidence. He tried to look offended, but the result was a parody.
I hope you're not implying that we're trying to keep something from you.
Why would I think that?
I have no idea.
He stood up.
And now, I'm afraid, I've run out of time.
Jeannie got up and preceded him to the door. He followed her down the stairs to the lobby.
Good day to you, he said stiffly.
Goodbye, she said. Outside the door, she hesitated. She felt combative. She was tempted to do something provocative, to show them they could not manipulate her totally. She decided to snoop around a bit. The parking lot was full of doctors' cars, late model Cadillacs and BMWs. She strolled around one side of the building. A black man with a white beard was sweeping up litter with a noisy blower. There was nothing remarkable or even interesting there. She came up against a blank wall and retraced her steps. Through the glass door at the front, she saw Dick Minsky still in the lobby, talking to the chirpy secretary. He watched anxiously as Jeannie walked by. Circling the building in the other direction, she came to the garbage dump. Three men wearing heavyweight gloves were loading trash onto a truck. This was stupid, Jeannie decided. She was acting like the detective in a hard-boiled mystery. She was about to turn back when something struck her. The men were lifting huge brown plastic sacks of trash, effortlessly, as if they weighed very little. What would a clinic be throwing away that was bulky but light? Shredded paper? She heard Dick Minsky's voice. He sounded scared.
Would you please leave now, Dr. Farami?
She turned. He was coming around the corner of the building, accompanied by a man in the police-style uniform used by security guards. She walked quickly to a stack of sacks.
Dick Minsky shouted, Hey!
The garbage men stared at her, but she ignored them. She ripped a hole in one sack, reached inside, and pulled out a handful of the contents. She was holding a sheaf of strips of thin brown card. When she looked closely at the strips, she could see they had been written on, some in pen and some with a typewriter. These were shredded hospital record cards. There could be only one reason why so many sacks were being taken away today. They had destroyed their records this morning, only hours after she had called. She dropped the shreds on the ground and walked away. One of the garbage men shouted at her indignantly, but she ignored him. Now there was no doubt. She stood in front of Dick Minsky, hands on hips. He had been lying to her, and that was why he was a nervous wreck.
You've got a shameful secret here, haven't you? She yelled. Something you're trying to hide by destroying these records?
He was completely terrified.
Of course not, he managed. And, by the way, the suggestion is offensive.
Of course it is, she said. Her temper got the better of her. She pointed at him with a rolled-up genetico brochure she was still carrying.
But this investigation is very important to me, and you'd better believe that anyone who lies to me about it is going to be fucked over but good before I'm finished. Please leave, he said.
The security guard took her by the left elbow.
I'm leaving, she said. No need to hold me.
He did not release her.
This way, please, he said.
He was a middle-aged man with gray hair and a pot belly. In this mood, Jeannie was not going to be mauled by him. With her right hand, she grasped the arm he was holding her with. The muscles of his upper arm were flabby.
Let go, please, she said.
And she squeezed. Her hands were strong, and her grip was more powerful than most men's. The guard tried to retain his grasp on her elbow, but the pain was too much for him, and after a moment, he released her.
Thank you, she said.
She walked away.
She felt better. She had been right to think there was a clue in this clinic. Their efforts to keep her from learning anything were the best possible confirmation that they had a guilty secret. The solution to the mystery was connected with this place. But where did that get her? She went to her car but did not get in. It was 2:30 and she had had no lunch. She was too excited to eat much, but she needed a cup of coffee. Across the street was a cafe next to a gospel hall. It looked cheap and clean. She crossed the road and went inside. Her threat to Dick Minsky had been empty. There was nothing she could do to harm him. She had achieved nothing by getting mad at him. In fact, she had tipped her hand, making it clear that she knew she was being lied to. Now they were on their guard. The cafe was quiet, but for a few students finishing lunch. She ordered coffee and a salad. While she was waiting, she opened the brochure she had picked up in the lobby of the clinic. She read, "The Aventine Clinic was founded in 1972 by Genetico Incorporated as a pioneering center for research and development of human in vitro fertilization, the creation of what the newspapers call test tube babies." And suddenly it was all clear. 34. Jane Edelsborough was a widow in her early 50s. A statuesque but untidy woman, she normally dressed in loose ethnic clothes and sandals. She had a commanding intellect, but no one would have guessed it to look at her. Barrington found such people baffling. If you were clever, he thought, why disguise yourself as an idiot by dressing badly? Yet universities were full of such people. In fact, he was exceptional in taking care over his appearance. Today, he was looking especially natty in a navy linen jacket and matching vest with lightweight houndstooth check pants. He inspected his image in the mirror behind the door before leaving his office on his way to see Jane. He headed for the student union. Faculty rarely ate there. Barrington had never entered the place, but Jane had gone there for a late lunch, according to the chatty secretary in physics. The lobby of the union was full of kids in shorts standing in line to get money out of the bank teller machines. He stepped into the cafeteria and looked around. She was in a far corner, reading a journal and eating French fries with her fingers. The place was a food court, such as Barrington had seen in airports and shopping malls, with a Pizza Hut, an ice cream counter, and a Burger King, as well as a regular cafeteria. Barrington picked up a tray and went into the cafeteria section. Inside a glass-fronted case were a few tired sandwiches and some doleful cakes. He shuddered. In normal circumstances, he would drive to the next state rather than eat here. This was going to be difficult. Jane was not his kind of woman. That made it even more likely that she would lean the wrong way at the discipline hearing. He had to make a friend of her in a short time. It would call for all his powers of charm. He bought a piece of cheesecake and a cup of coffee and carried them to Jane's table. He felt jittery, but he forced himself to look and sound relaxed.
Jane, he said, this is a pleasant surprise.
May I join you?
Sure,
she said amiably, putting her journal aside. She took off her glasses, revealing deep brown eyes with wrinkles of amusement at the corners. But she looked a mess. Her long gray hair was tied in some kind of colorless rag, and she wore a shapeless gray-green blouse with sweat marks at the armpits.
I don't think I've ever seen you in here, she said.
I've never been here.
But at our age, it's important not to get set in our ways. Don't you agree?
I'm younger than you, she said mildly, although I guess no one would think so. Sure they would. He took a bite of his cheesecake. The base was as tough as cardboard, and the filling tasted like lemon-flavored shaving cream. He swallowed with an effort. What do you think of Jack Budgeon's proposed biophysics library?
Is that why you came to see me?
I didn't come here to see you. I came to try the food. And I wish I hadn't. It's awful.
How can you eat here?
She dug a spoon into some kind of dessert.
I don't notice what I eat, Barry. I think about my particle accelerator.
Tell me about the new library. Barrington had been like her, obsessed by work once upon a time. He had never allowed himself to look like a hobo on account of it, but nevertheless, as a young scientist, he had lived for the thrill of discovery. However, his life had taken a different direction. His books were popularizations of other people's work. He had not written an original paper in 15 or 20 years. For a moment, he wondered whether he might have been happier if he had made a different choice. Slovenly Jane, eating cheap food while she ruminated over problems in nuclear physics, had an air of calm and contentment that Barrington had never known. And he was not managing to charm her. She was too wise. Perhaps he should flatter her intellectually.
I just think you should have a bigger input. You're the senior physicist on campus, one of the most distinguished scientists JFU has. You ought to be involved in this library.
Is it even going to happen?
I think Genetico is going to finance it.
Well, that's a piece of good news. But what's your interest?
30 years ago, I made my name when I started asking which human characteristics are inherited and which are learned. Because of my work and the work of others like me, we now know that a human being's genetic inheritance is more important than his upbringing and environment in determining a whole range of psychological traits.
Nature, not nurture.
Exactly. I proved that a human being is his DNA. The young generation is interested in how this process works. What is the mechanism by which a combination of chemicals gives me blue eyes, and another combination gives you eyes which are a deep, dark shade of brown. Almost chocolate-colored, I guess.
Barry, she said with a wry smile, if I were a 30-year-old secretary with perky breasts, I might imagine you were flirting with me.
That was better, he thought. She had softened at last.
Perky, he said, grinning. He deliberately looked at her bust, then back up at her face.
I believe you're as perky as you feel.
She laughed, but he could tell she was pleased. At last he was getting somewhere with her. Then she said, I have to go. Damn! He could not keep control of this interaction. He had to get her attention in a hurry. He stood up to leave with her.
There will probably be a committee to oversee the creation of the new library, he said, as they walked out of the cafeteria. I'd like your opinion on who should be on it.
Gosh, I'll need to think about that. Right now, I have to give a lecture on antimatter.
God damn it, I'm losing her, Barrington thought.
Then she said, can we talk again?
Barrington grasped at a straw.
How about over dinner?
She looked startled.
All right, she said after a moment.
Tonight?
A bemused look came over her face.
Why not?
That would give him another chance, at least.
Relieved, he said, I'll pick you up at 8.
Okay.
She gave him her address, and he made a note in a pocket pad.
What kind of food do you like? He said.
Oh, don't answer that. I remember. You think about your particle accelerator.
They emerged into the hot sun. He squeezed her arm lightly.
See you tonight.
Barry, she said, you're not after something, are you?
He winked at her.
What have you got?
She laughed and walked away.
35. Test tube babies, in vitro fertilization. That was the link. Jeannie saw it all. Charlotte Pinker and Lorraine Logan had both been treated for subfertility at the Aventine Clinic. The clinic had pioneered in vitro fertilization, the process by which sperm from the father and an egg from the mother are brought together in the laboratory, and the resulting embryo is then implanted in the woman's womb. Identical twins occur when an embryo splits in half in the womb and becomes two individuals. That might have happened in the test tube. Then the twins from the test tube could have been implanted in two different women. That was how identical twins could be born to two unrelated mothers. Bingo! The waitress brought Jeannie's salad, but she was too excited to eat it. Test tube babies were no more than a theory in the early 70s, she was sure, but Genetico had obviously been years ahead in its research. Both Lorraine and Charlotte said they had been given hormone therapy. It seemed the clinic had lied to them about their treatment. That was bad enough, but as Jeannie thought through the implications, she realized something worse. The embryo that split might have been the biological child of Lorraine and Charles, or of Charlotte and the Major, but not both. One of them had been implanted with another couple's child. Jeannie's heart filled with horror and loathing as she realized they could both have been given the babies of total strangers. She wondered why Genetico had deceived its patients in this appalling way. The technique was untried. Perhaps they needed human guinea pigs. Maybe they had applied for permission and had been refused. Or they could have had some other reason for secrecy. Whatever their motive for lying to the women, Jeannie now understood why her investigation scared Genetico so badly. Impregnating a woman with an alien embryo, without her knowledge, was about as unethical as could be imagined. It was no wonder they were desperate to cover it up. If Lorraine Logan ever found out what had been done to her, there would be hell to pay. She took a sip of coffee. The drive to Philadelphia had not been wasted after all. She did not yet have all the answers, but she had solved the central puzzle. It was deeply satisfying. Looking up, she was astonished to see Steve walk in. She blinked and stared. He was wearing khakis and a blue button-down, and as he came in, he closed the door behind him with his heel. She smiled broadly and stood up to greet him. "Steve," she said delightedly. Remembering her resolution, she threw her arms around him and kissed him on the lips. He smelled different today, less tobacco and more spice. He hugged her to him and kissed her back. She heard the voice of an older woman saying, "My God, I remember when I felt like that." And several people laughed. She released him. "Sit here. Do you want something to eat? Share my salad. What are you doing here? I can't believe it. You must have followed me. No, you knew the name of the clinic and you decided to meet me." "I just felt like talking to you." He smoothed his eyebrows with the tip of his index finger. Something about the action bothered her. "Who else have I seen do that?" But she pushed it to the back of her mind. "You go in for big surprises." Suddenly he seemed edgy. "I do." "You like to show up unexpectedly, don't you?"
"I guess so."
She smiled at him. "You're a little strange today. What's on your mind?"
"Listen, you got me all hot and bothered," he said. "Can we get out of here?"
"Sure." She put a $5 bill on the table and stood up.
"Where's your car?" she said as they stepped outside. "Let's take yours."
They got into the red Mercedes. She fastened her seat belt, but he did not. As soon as she pulled away, he edged close to her on the bench seat, lifted her hair and started kissing her neck. She liked it, but she felt embarrassed, and she said, "I think we may be a little too old to do this in a car."